Welcome back to the Hacking Neurodivergence Podcast, the show all about atypical people like you and me. I'm your host, Kelsey Terry, and today I sit down with Melissa, a therapist diagnosed with autism later in life. We cover a host of topics and strategies. I know you're going to walk away with some practical insights. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Melissa. Welcome to the show, Melissa.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
In today's conversation, we'll discuss your work as a therapist, the impact of meditation in your life. In the second part, we'll learn more about your relationship with Ben and becoming a new mom. How's that sound?
Sounds great. Do it.
Let's go back to elementary school. Tell me a little bit about younger Melissa.
Sure. So thinking back on those years, a time that really stands out to me would be around like second grade, which is kind of when I started to maybe show some signs of neurodivergence coming out. And, you know, funnily enough, there was actually some of the classic like ADHD things going on. But yeah, lots of context about that. But those things were kind of missed at the time. But, you know, it was just things like not being able to sit still, kind of acting out in class, like, you know, poking my seat partner and, you know, kind of distracting the teachers, let's just say. So I got some not so favorable report cards and like commenting on my behavior that I would take home and like hide in my toy bin on like underneath my toys. And yeah, it's just interesting because there's sort of a whole story that goes with that, which is, you know, I started feeling kind of ashamed for all this. I was like, oh, like, I don't want to be causing trouble. You know, I don't want to, you know, have more for my parents to deal with, because they had kind of a handful with my two older brothers going on. And that summer, we took a trip to the Grand Canyon. And we did like a road trip every summer and went camping. It was really fun. And that summer, my parents just loved to tell the story. Apparently, we finally got to get to the Grand Canyon and I'm looking out, you know, over the beautiful vista, this beautiful natural landscape. And apparently I just looked really pensive and kind of staring off into the distance. And one of them asked me like, oh, like, you know, what are you thinking about? What do you think of this? And I said something like, no, I just want to be a better person. And yeah, I guess at that point, it really, like, they spin that as such a, like, positive, cool story of, like, oh, she, you know, she was so self-aware. She was so mature for her age. But I, now, at this point in my life, I see that actually is very sadly kind of, like, not to be too intense, but almost like the death of like kind of me unmasked. Because I think following that, I just really started to be like, oh, I want to be good in school. I want to be a good girl. I want to be a good daughter. I want to be, you know, well-behaved, not get in trouble and do these things that people seem to want from me. And so I could really see that, honestly, as like the start of when I really just started to kind of mask a lot and people please and started to be a lot more aware of kind of like my presence and like how I was coming across around other people and like almost like hyper aware of that, right? To the point where I think that really fueled like a lot of my introversion and just kind of, I mean, other people sort of saw it as like, oh, she's shy. But for me, it was just like, oh, you know, I don't want to be weird. I don't want to be annoying. I don't want to be distracting. And so, yeah, I could really see that as like a pivotal shaping point in the way that I presented myself around people and in definitely in social situations.
I'm curious with regards to like the report that came back of, you know, Melissa's, you know, really, really active in her seat or she's maybe interrupting the class. What was your parents' reaction
like when those notes would maybe have to get signed by your parents?
I think what happened was, I had been hiding these reports. And then they go in for the parent-teacher conference and they were kind of like blindsided because the teacher was like, Melissa's generally doing well in school. However, her behavior, on the other hand, and they were just shocked. They did not see that coming at all. So, they came home and I definitely got in trouble and they like were like, where are all these report cards? The teacher said they've been sending home with you. We haven't seen them. And so I had to dig under all my toys and show them. And so, I got definitely got in trouble for that. But in terms of like the reaction or sort of what maybe how they tried to lecture me about that, I don't quite remember what they said. But I remember getting in trouble at least for that.
Did then spawn like on, hey, let's go get you diagnosed? Or was it like, hey, Melissa, just be better. Like, let's white knuckle good behavior in school. What was like kind of the next steps as like second grade Melissa? If there were any.
Certainly nothing regarding like help, with the via the school programs or assistance or anything like that. I think it was either just kind of missed or like not to the point where maybe the staff thought it warranted any exploration or recommendations to get assessed or anything. So nothing happened in terms of that route. I'm not sure. I think probably just like, you need to learn how to, how to behave better in school. Probably it's just the general, what I got from my parents.
Sure. Let's fast forward to high school. What was high school like for you?
High school, I found that what really helped me kind of get through that time was having extracurricular activities that I really enjoyed, because that's how I found my friends. That's how I really was able to engage in that kind of experience and not feel really lost, not feel like I was kind of alone. Because I definitely by that point, like middle school, well, at that point is called junior high, but that was a very, it's awkward for everyone, I think, but it was a really, really awkward time for me. And that was kind of the point where I started to not really understand like social hierarchy stuff, like what clothes am I supposed to be wearing? Like, how do I fit in kind of thing? And by high school, I think just knowing that if I joined, the certain sports I was in, or I was in orchestra, that I'm like, okay, I have my groups that accept me and that I have really solid friends through those activities. And that was just, I would say like the definitely number one thing that helped that be a somewhat positive experience. Actually, interestingly enough, my dad was a high school teacher. So he was there at my high school and actually had him for one of my classes one year. So that was pretty interesting.
Was he like the cool teacher, or was it like, oh no, let's pretend I don't know my dad?
It was a little bit of both. I mean, he was really well respected, but he was kind of known for being one of the more tough teachers, because his philosophy was like having the coursework be kind of closer to what it looks like in college versus high school. And some of the kids were like, this is too much.
sure. I love that. So you found a sense of community in these co-curriculars. Did you find people like you, or was it more because it was like a shared goal? That's where how you were able to like find connection. Was it, like at a people level, or was it like maybe a shared focus because you're all in this, activity together?
Yeah, I would say probably a bit of both. I think having just the activity that, for sports, it was track and cross country that I did. And so, doing the workouts, going on runs together, having something to do while socializing is just
yeah, really important. and then I would say that, yeah, within that, there were some people that, I don't know, I just felt like, yeah, an extra affinity with and kind of jived with a little bit better. And so that was always fun just to like, yeah, have some closer friends within those circles.
Yeah, I'll say I always loved school because it was almost like forced socialization where like summers were very lonely, but like school was amazing because you were in the presence of all these other kids either doing school or co-curriculars. And I always kind of relished that when many people would like complain about school.
Yeah.
It was like, yes, I get something to do. And we're going to go do this together.
Okay, so you're kind of finding your space and you know, run cross country, you're in the arts a bit. Talk to me about your college experience. Was it more of the same or was it radically different moving out of your, you know, childhood home?
College was definitely an interesting transition point. I think that's when I really started to hyper focus on school as an area that I could really excel in, and definitely some perfectionistic tendencies started to ramp up a lot at that point. I was lucky enough. One of the things I was really worried about was, yeah, again, kind of the social aspect, like, oh my gosh, now it's like this huge environment. How am I going to find friends? You know, obviously there's clubs and activities and things you can join, but it felt so overwhelming, like, you know, such a bigger scale. But it just so happened that during orientation, there was someone in my small group that was from my hometown. I was like, we were just like instant friends at that point. And then I kind of was able to meet friends from that one person. And that's like how I had all of my friends for college, which was very nice. It was like one connection and then it sort of branched out from there, which I personally liked a lot because then I didn't have to keep redoing that process over and over again of like meeting someone new, going through that first, initial phase of friendship, which is very difficult for me personally.
Yeah.
But I definitely started getting really focused on like, oh, wow, like college is a place where I can really kind of focus my efforts and do well in my classes. And back in high school, I had started to feel definitely like some self-esteem issues coming up. I think my first kind of bout of depression had started in high school, potentially also with like, so a lot of hormonal shifts going on at that point too, let's be honest. So, and I definitely felt like the beginnings of this, like, yeah, I just really feel different. I feel like I struggle with day-to-day things. Like at that point, I didn't know the word for it, but it was definitely like executive dysfunction. And just like my parents are very, I call them very industrious type of people that just seem to really like, you know, get things done, do this work. They're productive, they're efficient. And like, yeah, there's just this sense for me of like, I just don't feel that way. I don't operate that way. And I felt like there was something lacking. So yeah, for me, it felt like, oh, school is this arena where I can be more like that, where I can kind of, I mean, I guess it didn't feel directly like coming home to my parents like, oh, look, my 4.0, but kind of, you know, it's like, hey, yeah, mom and dad, I'm doing really well in college, doing well in school. And they'd be like, that's great. I'm like, yeah, that feels nice that I can, you know, meet societal standards in some way that's validated. So yeah, that kind of started being this, yeah, a large part of my identity, I think, of just like, oh yeah, I'm good at school. And that was something that I could feel good about and address some of those, yeah, self-esteem issues.
So at this time, you're just crushing school academically. Are you like thinking, I'm going to go into therapy? I'm going to like be an undergrad in psychology. Tell me about like the evolution from college into pursuing your therapy career.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely in high school, I started really noticing my interest in people, how people work. Weird, right? Like, I wonder how people work. So, yeah, definitely started getting inklings of that in high school. And that's ultimately what led me to choose, psychology as my major for college. And I definitely felt that as I started taking my psychology classes in college, I was like, oh, yeah, I really love this stuff. Like, I kind of knew like it was right. So from there, I think the main things I was considering in terms of pathways would be like, do I want to go down kind of a more research route, or do I want to go therapy? I mean, those obviously are the only two options, but they were the ones that kind of stuck out. So I definitely had the opportunity to assist some professors with their research in college, which was very cool. And I did like it, but I think, I don't know, there was something just really calling to me about therapy work where I was like, I just love having, you know, these deep one-on-one conversations with people. I think definitely working up to that point, I had had these experiences where people would just kind of naturally feel kind of comfortable around me and just start telling me stuff anyway, like divulging, you know, kind of their like not deepest, darkest secrets, but they just, kind of confiding in me and that kind of thing. So I'm like, maybe I'm well suited toward this, maybe, you know, aspects of my personality, my, you know, empathy, that kind of thing would be conducive for this. And I didn't get the chance to necessarily test that out as much as I had done with the research idea. But I did take, a couple of classes that were a little bit more about psychotherapy, and I just really enjoyed that. So, I think I just really decided that that felt more right to me. And once I graduated college, I worked for a year at a recovery center for eating disorders. That was really jumping into the deep end of that kind
of work. Yes, it is.
The field. It was pretty intense, but I would say that I was able to learn a lot really quickly. And then from there, I had applied to do my master's of mental health counseling at Western Washington. And so that's, kind of where my pathway led me.
And I'm curious, did you receive counseling growing up? Did you have exposure to other therapists and say like, oh, yes, I want to be just like so-and-so? Is that maybe what put you on that path?
Funny enough, not necessarily. My first experience of being in therapy wasn't until after college. I had been through a really rough breakup and got into kind of a deeper depression at that point. And so that was kind of my first entry point into seeking out therapy. But since then, I've definitely been a little out of therapy because I really believe in it. And I find it interesting. I mean, as a therapist myself, all the providers that I've seen just kind of, experiencing a lot of different styles, a lot of different personalities and different approaches is really cool.
Speaking of styles, there's DBT, there's CBT. And I mean, obviously, there's many flavors of therapy that exist. Tell me what appeals to you about, is it DBT?
Yeah, so DBT stands for Dialectic Behavioral Therapy. What really stood out to me about DBT, maybe in comparison to CBT, although it doesn't need to be compared, but it really focuses much more on emotion regulation and incorporating, it was one of the first approaches actually to incorporate mindfulness techniques. I mean, since then, kind of a lot of them have really, especially CBT has added that on too. But yeah, there was just more of this idea of like acceptance work and validating your emotions and understanding kind of where these things come from, as opposed to, I mean, maybe this is a little bit of a simplistic explanation of CBT, but just for me, how it felt was like, let's identify your irrational thoughts and correct them and change them. And that just rubbed me the wrong way personally. I know it's really helpful for a lot of people. I don't want to, yeah, knock that. But I think for certain types of people that DBT especially was designed for, I would say, are people who have very strong emotionality, very sensitive to emotions, have intense emotions, and have experienced, you know, what we would call like chronic invalidation a lot of the time, unfortunately, from parents or even, yeah, just from peers, people around. And so the way that DBT works really helps people kind of in that boat feel like they're not wrong for the way that they feel. It's just that there's a way that we can work with emotions more effectively, and thus shaping behavior, shaping the way that you cope. That's why a lot of how DBT works is learning all these coping skills. So the way that we do the therapy for kind of gold standard DBT is having individual DBT sessions, as well as attending a group where you learn all these coping skills that go with DBT. So I'm a huge proponent of, yeah, those skills, because they're just really helpful to have tools like that that you can access in the moment, or just kind of as a foundational way to increase your resilience and effectiveness.
I'm curious, with regards to the audience that's listening in and they've maybe heard a little bit about DBT, would you in broad strokes recommend DBT for neurodivergent individuals, or would you say it's hyper personal and like every person is different, therefore I cannot make a recommendation? What are your thoughts on neurodivergent people plus DBT?
Yeah. This is my answer to a lot of things. It's a bit of both. where I think from what I recall, DBT actually has been used fairly effectively for people with ADHD. And I think part of that is because, you know, we can see some of those similarities from what I was just talking about in terms of like the emotion regulation, impulsivity, that kind of thing is exactly what DBT can be helpful for. So yeah, I would say in that direction, probably could be one of the options to at least consider for somebody. And yeah, then again, everyone's really different. I mean, DBT,
of course,
it's particularly structured, and it has definitely its own kind of thing to it where, yeah, for some people, it's just not their jam. That is totally okay. And I, there's something out there that feels maybe like a better fit. But I think, yeah, just kind of knowing about it, the awareness of this is an approach that exists, even just checking it out, if anyone's curious, I think, yeah, keeping open-minded about it.
So you once led a group meditation at my former company. And naturally, meditation continues to gain popularity and momentum, especially in the West. What benefits have you seen from meditation, maybe in your practice or personally?
Yeah, definitely both. Meditation and even just, I would say, mindfulness skills in general are hugely important, especially for those DBT skills that I was just talking about. That's the mindfulness skills are like the foundational layer of all the other skills that we teach. So we kind of keep revisiting them over and over again for that sake, is like being able to observe and describe with awareness what's going on, like within you, your thoughts, your emotions, your body sensations, you know, your behaviors, And having that kind of like, we call it an observer's stance, where you're able to, instead of having it kind of be, feel like it is you, you're kind of all consumed by what's going on. You're able to like get that kind of metaphorical step back where you can really have a different perspective and, like I said, observe and describe what is going on. Ideally in like non-judgmental language, right? That's a huge, huge part of what I work on with people is like, you know, let's just take, you know, I'm so lazy, for example. Okay, what does that really mean? If someone said that to me, one of my clients, I'm like, okay, let's unpack that, right? Because you say that to me, I don't even know what that means. It could mean you didn't do your laundry today. It could mean you, you know, put off doing your school assignment. Let's actually, you know, using descriptive factual language, walk through that situation. So I would say that's a way to use mindfulness skills that doesn't have to be formal meditation, like, you know, sitting on a cushion for, you know, however many minutes, although obviously that's a great practice to implement as well. But I think that's maybe a barrier for a lot of people is like, oh, meditation, you know, it has to be this like calm zen, I have to set aside all this time for it. Like, it doesn't have to be that way. It could be truly just kind of checking in with yourself of like, how am I feeling right now? I really just take a moment. Can I notice what my body feels like? Can I start to describe, yeah, any emotions that I'm having or thoughts that I'm noticing? And I think that application of mindfulness is just huge. Like I was saying, for awareness and kind of that stepping off point in terms of either through that information, then that leading you to some kind of coping skill. Or even just like really learning about yourself and your patterns. What's keeping me stuck? What do I tend to keep doing over and over again that I'd like to change? So yeah, I think all of that can be immensely helpful.
Well, so you mentioned, right, that stepping back or maybe even interrogating some of your thoughts. We as neurodivergent people can sometimes get in those loops, right? I'm worthless or I'm whatever. Like, again, so insert negative statement about self. So it sounds like there's meditation, there's interrogating the thoughts. Like, well, why do you think that? Or what does that actually mean to be a loser or whatever it might be? Are there other tools you might highlight or recommend to get people out of like those loops we can find ourselves in?
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, I would say one route is kind of, as you were just saying, a little bit more cognitive where you're kind of examining the thoughts, maybe applying some of those types of skills. But I would say another route that might be helpful, especially since mental loops are pretty cognitive in and of themselves, trying to use more cognition to like get yourself out of it can kind of be a rabbit hole, so to speak. So what might actually even be more effective to like nap out of that, so to speak, is like something that really activates you that's more like what we'd call bottom up instead of top down. What I mean by that is something that really is like more physiological based, maybe something more sensory based. There are a set of skills that really lean more into that realm. Where it's like, okay, let me maybe activate my sense of smell and like have this bag of like lavender that I can smell. Or let me go outside and just start to really like look at trees, look at leaves, kind of. I mean, there's certain activities you could do, like counting the number of things you can see that are blue or anything like that, really. For a lot of people, it could be something body-based, like movement, yoga, going for a run, that kind of thing, where you're really just kind of shifting the mode that you're in. Yeah, I think especially if it's like, it's been so much of that thinking, can we like just jump into something completely different? I would say even something like, I don't know, taking a hot shower and then turning it to cold at the end. Like, I mean, that's maybe intense, but hey, that could really help to just like reset the system potentially.
Well, let's shift into your journey of getting diagnosed, of being on the spectrum. Bring me back to maybe the months leading up to that realization and that aha moment for yourself.
Well, interestingly enough, through working with some of my clients who were diagnosed with ADHD, they would talk about those experiences and I'd be like, wait a minute. I feel like I'm identifying quite a lot with what you're saying. And it just kind of, got more on my radar, especially the fact that, ADHD can present so differently in women or people identifying as women. So I started looking more into that first. And the more that I looked into it, the more that, I felt pretty validated, pretty like it explained a lot. So that was my first route of kind of going down the pathway of getting diagnosed. So I was diagnosed with that. I think that was in like 2021. So I began working with providers for that, trying out some different medications. I didn't quite have what a lot of people seem to talk about with the medication effect with ADHD of like, I started taking it all of a sudden. It's like, whoa, my brain feels like it's really working. It's clicking in. I just kind of noticed a lot of like the physical side effects. I think it did help, but I had kind of a hard time with finding like the right type and the right dose and things like that. So as I was sort of working through that process, there was also something that was like, I don't know, it still feels like a piece of the puzzle is missing here. Like, it explains a lot. And there's also, I guess, what felt to me like this whole other side of what was going on that wasn't really explained. And I think, well, now what I know, people who identify as being ADHDers, which is autistic ADHD, kind of explain this like really internal battle, almost like between the two of like some of the, for ADHD, kind of feeling like, my interests are kind of like hopping around all over the place. I want to seek novelty. I want to seek fun. I want to kind of have these different experiences. And then there's this other side of me that's like, no, we want to stay in our safe place at home. We want the same routine. We want structure. We want rigidity. Like, so it felt like there's kind of always this constant battle within myself, which often leads to like paralysis of like an overwhelm. A lot of paralysis and overwhelm. So I've experienced. So I guess at that point I was like, it feels like something's missing. I don't really know what it is though. And then wouldn't you know it, yet again, I have some clients that are autistic or that have gotten diagnosed and they're, talking about their experience. And I'm like, this is happening again. Wait a minute. I'm seeing myself in these descriptions. And I think, for Bull, this actually could be a lack in the department of like my schooling, especially for my counseling degree. We really did not touch on these areas hardly at all. So even being a therapist, like I felt like I didn't have actually that much knowledge of either ADHD or autism. I just kind of had basically the kind of, unfortunately, the classic presentation in my mind for both. And that's, much more likely to be the way that, boys or males are kind of presenting, right? And so I was able to really start into so much So much research. That's one of my like brain just passions,
skills.
So deep into research. So you better bet that as soon as I started suspecting that that could be the case, I was like, okay, it's on. Let me dig into this autism research and how it presents in women, especially. And I just was like fascinated by what I found. And I'm like, oh, wow. Okay. I think this is sort of like rounding out the picture here for me. Where, yeah, I can really identify with having both. And it just felt like this huge, aha moment that I was also kind of like, yeah, how did I not see this before? Although I kind of knew why. And I mean, there is neurodivergence in my family. So part of me was like, what, how did I not suspect this? So knowing that, there's a potentially genetic component there. But yeah, things were just really all clicking into place by that point. And just, I would say, it was a hugely validating feeling because I suddenly had all of this new language for things that I had been experiencing my whole life that I just wrote off as either being weird or like just really strange or unhelpful or, you know, insert negative word here. That's just so sad to me that I had lived so much of my life thinking that a lot of these things were like character flaws or just things about me that I didn't like or things that kept me from feeling like I fit in with people. So, I would say that really understanding those pieces and giving me that language to use was probably one of the best things about both, kind of realizing this and also, you know, seeking out a diagnosis. Like, okay, this is what's going on. And then being able to use that language, especially with my husband, but people around me that could understand that as well. I would say that's definitely a really, really big part of what has felt helpful for me at this point and really helps me then think of how to cope with that and tools I can use as well.
When I talk to other neurodivergent people, they will sometimes minimize their neurodivergence of like, well, I'm not officially diagnosed. Like I haven't gone through the battery of tests from a therapist. Like, is that okay? Like, can I have Asperger's and not have a therapist tell me that? And I'm curious. I hold the perspective of you don't have to have a therapist give you a sticker. Like, you are officially in this club. Unless you're in school and you really need special services. But you are a professional therapist. What are your thoughts on, like, whether or not to get an official diagnosis versus, like, I did a quiz on BuzzFeed about my ADHD?
I think that's kind of a tricky question that I have a little bit of a maybe convoluted answer for, which is
that's okay.
In general, I would say that I can see the helpfulness and validity of self-diagnosis. However, I would say that that comes with a bit of I'm trying to figure out how to put it. Like, right, you mentioned kind of like, okay, yeah, a 10-minute, you know, quiz on BuzzFeed is a lot different than really kind of, doing your due diligence, putting in research and understanding that, I mean, there's some of these trends that have gone around on social media where it's like, oh, if you do this one or two things, you could be, you know, on the spectrum. It's like, okay, well, we have to realize that the whole point of, you know, being on the spectrum is like, it's this constellation of all these different traits and areas that can be observed. where you can't just simplify it down to kind of these like anecdotal quirks or like a couple of things where in isolation it's like, oh, if I do that, that must mean XYZ. No, not necessarily, right? There's so much overlap, right? So it's more of like the bigger picture of how some of those things are really operating all together. And I think there are free and also, you know, pretty reputable sources online that's kind of that middle ground, right? Where it's like, okay, I'm not doing the full official diagnosis, but I'm also not watching a TikTok that's telling me that I'm autistic, right? So yeah, I think there's sort of a sweet spot with self-diagnosis there where it's, yeah, kind of understanding, not necessarily jumping to conclusions. But, you know, then again, I think it is complicated, right? We could see some overlap here with a lot of different things. I mean, I guess that kind of goes the other way too, where the realm of traits can get kind of messy with, I would say, borderline personality disorder, trauma, bipolar disorder, autism, ADHD. Like those are all kind of like swimming around, sharing a lot of traits and behaviors and things like that. So I think, yeah, that could really trip people up and it can feel confusing. But I would say, yeah, in general, if you're noticing these larger patterns of things like difficulty socializing, you really can kind of see all these different areas of how that's affecting you, or like something like sensory sensitivities. If you have sensory sensitivities, you have them, right? You can say that, experience that. So, you know, you can't say that that's not happening. So I would say being able to really validate and, yeah, kind of use the language that does fit your experience is really helpful, like it was for me, as I was saying before. I think that can feel really empowering to be like, oh, this is what's going on. And using that language and being able to then kind of through that access resources or tools that could be helpful for you.
I wonder if someone walks into your office and they say, I am ADHD, I think I have Asperger, like they just give you a whole battery of things that they think that they have. And maybe they were diagnosed in the past. Do you take that at face value, or over the arc of your relationship with the client, do you kind of like double check, like, I don't know if you have borderline personality or PTSD. I'm curious, just how do you like intake that information when sometimes people can be very label forward in, you know, present day?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. So for my area of expertise, it wouldn't be diagnosing ADHD or autism. So that would kind of just be, you know, incorporating what they're sharing with me is, yeah, kind of how they are experiencing that and kind of working with that. For other potential diagnoses, well, one of the things that I really loved about GBT and just the way that especially my mentor practiced it is not as diagnosis heavy. It's more like, let's just take you as a person and your particular behaviors and symptoms and things, goals, things that you want to work on. Let's just work with that. Because, you know, at the end of the day, whether it has the label or not, that's what's going on. So I think it can inform certain things. It can be like a backdrop that can kind of provide some context potentially. And yet, at least for me personally, I wouldn't, you know, rely so heavily on, you know, knowing that for sure, or really saying like, oh yeah, you know, this is what's going on. And yeah, more so working from kind of those personal details of that, you know, individual person, because right, it's an individual person with their own way. I mean, two people with depression could be wildly different from one another, right? So what's Agreed. The point of really overly focusing on, okay, you have depression, I have these preconceived notions of what that might mean. That's not very helpful, right? So yeah, I would say working with each person yeah, much more personally and an individual basis, more helpful.
Oh, that was so much fun. I love talking shop with therapists. I have a weird number of them in my life, and it's always fun to hear like how they approach it because it's so unique. It's so personal for every person's practice. Next, we're going to shift into your relationship with Ben. Ben was on the show 2 weeks ago, and he shared he's neurodivergent. Talk to me about your long-term relationship with Ben and both of you being neurodivergent. How do you guys navigate that as a couple?
Yeah. So at the beginning, both of us not knowing any of our neurodivergence, I think we could kind of tell that there were some ways that we like butted heads with each other, our certain, idiosyncrasies, our certain areas of rigidity. I think, at the beginning that did lead to some little tiffs, some discussions, as we would call it, not necessarily like full on fights or arguments or anything, but just both of us could get kind of in this like really stubborn place. And then it's kind of that stalemate of like, well, you don't understand me. Well, you don't understand what I'm saying, that whole thing. I would say it took kind of a while for us to really work around that main issue of, kind of that stalemate. But again, I feel like this theme of like the language, like having this language to use, I'm going to bring that up again, because I would say that was the number one thing that just immensely helped that problem, which was having this shared language to use around what was going on. That was what kind of finally unlocked that feeling of like, oh, you do understand. Oh, okay. The way that I'm fixating on this thing is just how my brain is working on it. And that's what your brain is doing. Oh, okay. We're not just being like the stubborn idiots.
Let me ask you this. So both of you have, my understanding of your stories is that both of you have, a more recent diagnosis. I think the two of you are both in your mid-30s. Am I correct in assuming that? Perfect. And so what has your integration work look like, right? You're a therapist. You have this shared language of neurodivergence. Bring me to your like kitchen table as the two of you are unpacking that. Like you said, you are observing those stalemates you have. Any other advice that you might have for other neurodivergent couples that might be listening to this podcast?
Yeah. I would say that being able to, kind of put voice to, well, for me, for example, one of the things that would come up frequently is my executive dysfunction, having a really hard time with stuff like daily tasks that would be very helpful for me to, chip in with, like housework, chores, that kind of thing. And that had been an ongoing issue, and I had felt like I didn't have the words to explain why stuff like that was so hard for me. So then when I finally was able to really describe that, then it became kind of, instead of this me feeling ashamed and him being like, hey, but also you still need to help out, trying to find ways that, I could use like workarounds or little techniques or ways that felt more in line with what would actually work with kind of the way my brain works, right? Or things like kind of peculiarities with sensitivities, knowing that's what was going on and being able to talk about that, huge. I have kind of a sensitivity for touch at times. And that was an area that I think for Ben was kind of hard to understand with like, cuddling on the couch, stuff like that, or like putting a hand on me as we're watching a show. And I'm just like, I don't know, not feeling it. And that it's like, without having that language, like that could feel like a sting or like a feeling of rejection, right? And so I think for him being able to know that's what that was for me, and that it, it wasn't personal,
was a really big help. And then we, yeah, have been able to kind of talk together about ways like, okay, for me, touch feels great. It was like a hug. Like it's like an active thing. Like I know, this sounds funny. I know what we're doing. Like I know, like I'm kind of in more control of like what that's looking like. So yeah, things like that. I just found that it opened our minds to be able to understand each other better. And I think feel less confused or even less judgmental of the other's kind of particular ways of going about things, I guess.
I love that. I love the like the unexpected empathy that comes with like, oh, you're struggling too, and you're not being a jerk in the way that you show up, or I'm not being a jerk. Like, actually, we're both struggling in unspoken or hidden ways, and it just manifests differently. Next up, I want to hear about this life-changing event. You became a mom, and you are also neurodivergent. So how do you navigate having a newborn and sensory overwhelm and loud sounds?
It hasn't been easy. I will say that. It's been a huge adjustment that I'm constantly adjusting to at every moment. Yeah, I think Ben was mentioning when he was on the show that a lot of kind of the way that babies are is kind of like antithetical to like, you know, the unpredictable nature, like things are constantly changing. It's really hard to get that sense of routine. And yeah, and there's just been certain things that my mind has kind of latched onto that are not ideal. Let's just say that I can tend towards some aspects of like health anxiety. So especially when he was really newborn, like there was stuff that I would constantly be worrying about, like, oh, what's that? Oh, is that normal? Is that okay? Stuff like that. So that was an area that I really had to like, yeah, apply my skills, use mindfulness, get that perspective taking, you know, and definitely try not to doom research all the stuff that was going on. And then, yeah, I have kind of one area that my brain really wanted to be really rigid about was sort of this like almost science behind the sleep schedule, like naps, wake windows. It's this whole thing. Oh my gosh, there's so much information about it, which is to my detriment, I think, because there's just endless ways that I can look up and try to optimize and like try my best to control the situation. And I mean, all in all, I want him to have the sleep that he needs and, you know, try to do my best with that. However, I think the way that my brain really hyper-focuses on that is not very helpful for my mental health. So I've been trying to like find more of a middle ground with working on that. And I think I'm arriving at more of a sweet spot with that. But yeah, I would say that my touch sensitivity has been a huge, huge thing. I mean, I guess it was hard for me to envision all that would entail of like the breastfeeding process. And by this point, he's, you know, 6 months. So he's like squirming, he's grabbing, slobbering, like drool is everywhere, grabbing my hair, pinching my skin. Like, obviously, he doesn't mean to do all these things. And yet, like, that's a lot. It's a lot. So sometimes, what that might look like is, you know, I put him in his, you know, bouncer chair and I'm like, okay, we're going to take a break. I'm going to set you up with your toys and I'm going to go drink a cup of tea or something like that just to, like, yeah, kind of reset myself if I need to. And yeah, something like, you know, at the end of the day, after putting him down for bed, I'm just going to go like take a shower and yeah, do that kind of reset, do the things to take care of myself that can help, kind of adjust that meter for me of like all the bombardment throughout the day. It can be a lot.
I love to hear you're implementing all the things you just highlighted and even suggested for the audience of like take that shower, right? Step back and create physical space and do those handoffs. And I love to hear how the two of you have been tag teaming through that, because it's hard for any couple. I mean, to navigate, especially that first year, because it really disrupts all those patterns and habits and systems of what a dual income, no kids life can be.
Exactly.
After the conversation, I wanted to share my three key insights. Number one, when you're swirling in your mind, it's pretty hard to outthink your way out of that rumination or that situation. So instead, I would encourage you, and something I'm going to do, is change your environment or change your behavior in such a way that you're almost shaken, you're jarred out of that rut we can find ourselves in. This could be putting an ice cube on your wrist or going for a run or doing some meditation, stepping away from your desk at work. Number two, I thought it was remarkable that she had identified the very, very moment when she's standing at the edge of the Grand Canyon overlooking one of the most beautiful things in the world. And she said, "I want to be a better person," right? And her parents thought that was cute. And yet she saw that as the very moment in which she really began her masking. And it makes me wonder how long I have subconsciously been applying a mask in an effort to fit into culture's expectations. Third was the idea that when her and her husband were really struggling and they just couldn't see eye to eye and they were having difficulties like every married couple does, right? Or anyone in a long-term relationship, they can struggle. And yet there was something below the surface. There was something more that they were dealing with. And ultimately, you know, Ben was diagnosed neurodivergent, just like Melissa was. And so they had a neurodivergent household, right? So they thought that the other person was just being a jerk. And yet there was this layer of complexity to both of them. And my takeaway from that is we're just experts in our struggle and how we wish other people would do better or just like how much effort we're putting in. And yet I, and I know others, forget to afford that grace to someone else, right? And it may not result in so-and-so needs to get diagnosed, right? That's not necessarily like the natural progression for everyone. But that was Melissa's story. And what I'm going to carry forward is this idea of trying to be really, really cognizant to extend grace and empathy to the people I'm interacting with more often, because, right, I want that for myself. So why would I not give that or afford that to others who might be struggling with their own challenges, whether they be neurodivergent or not? If this episode was helpful to you, it would be the highest compliment if you'd be willing to consider sharing it with a friend. Maybe they're ruminating on something at work and they could hear some of Melissa's strategies firsthand. Share it with them. That, again, is the best thing you could possibly do for this podcast. Number two, if you are listening to my voice, I want you to be aware that we also have a video component to this podcast. So you can watch that on Spotify desktop, or you can watch it on YouTube as well. I'll link it all below so that you have easy access to those channels. But if you're a visual processor, know that this is being recorded and there is video if you want to watch it. Thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you guys next week.